The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. Chapter 24. In the face of all his handicaps, Jorgis was obliged to make the price of a lodging and of a drink every hour or two under penalty of freezing to death. Day after day he roamed about in the Arctic cold, his soul filled full of bitterness and despair. He saw the world of civilization then more plainly than ever he had seen it before, a world in which nothing counted but brutal might, an order devised by those who possessed it for the subjugation of those who did not. He was one of the latter, and all outdoors, all life, was to him one colossal prison, which he paced like a pent-up tiger, trying one bar after another, and finding them all beyond his power. He had lost in the fierce battle of greed, and so was doomed to be exterminated, and all society was busy to see that he did not escape the sentence. Everywhere that he turned were prison bars, and hostile eyes following him, the well-fed, sleek policemen from whose glances he shrank, and who seemed to grip their clubs more tightly when they saw him, the saloon keepers who never ceased to watch him while he was in their places, who were jealous of every moment he lingered after he had paid his money, the hurrying throngs upon the streets who were deaf to his entreaties, oblivious of his very existence, and savage and contemptuous when he forced himself upon them. They had their own affairs, and there was no place for him among them. There was no place for him anywhere. Every direction he turned his gaze, this fact was forced upon him. Everything was built to express it to him. The residences with their heavy walls and bolted doors and basement windows barred with iron, the great warehouses filled with the products of the whole world and guarded by iron shutters and heavy gates, the banks with their unthinkable billions of wealth all buried in safes and vaults of steel. And then one day there befell Jorgis the one adventure of his life. It was late at night, and he had failed to get the price of a lodging. Snow was falling, and he had been out so long that he was covered with it and was chilled to the bone. He was working among the theatre crowds, flitting here and there, taking large chances with the police, in his desperation, half hoping to be arrested. When he saw a bluecoat start toward him, however, his heart failed him, and he dashed down a side street and fled a couple of blocks. When he stopped again, he saw a man coming toward him and placed himself in his path. "Please, sir," he began in the usual formula, "will you give me the price of a lodging? I've had a broken arm and I can't work, and I've got not a cent in my pocket. I'm an honest working man, sir, and I never begged before. It's not my fault, sir." Jorgis usually went on until he was interrupted, but this man did not interrupt, and so at last he came to a breathless stop. The other had halted, and Jorgis suddenly noticed that he stood a little unsteadily. "Was that you say?" he queried suddenly in a thick voice. Jorgis began again, speaking more slowly and distinctly, before he was half through, the other put out his hand and rested it upon his shoulder.
"Poor chappy," he said. "Been up against it, eh?"
Then he lurched towards Jorgis, and the hand upon his shoulder became an arm about his neck.
"Up against it myself, old sport," he said. "She's a hard old world."
They were close to a lamppost, and Jorgis got a glimpse of the other. He was a young fellow, not much over 18, with a handsome boyish face. He wore a silk hat and a rich, soft overcoat with a fur collar, and he smiled at Jorgis with benignant sympathy.
"I'm hard up to my good friend," he said. "I've got cruel parents, or I'd set you up. What's the matter with you?" "I've been to the hospital." "Hospital!" exclaimed the young fellow, still smiling sweetly. "That's too bad. Same's my Aunt Polly. My Aunt Polly's in the hospital, too. Old auntie's been having twins. What's the matter with you?"
"I've got a broken arm," Jorgis began.
"So," said the other sympathetically, "that ain't so bad. You get over that. I wish somebody'd break my arm, old chappy, damn if I don't. Then they'd treat me better. Hold me up, old sport. What's it you want me to do?"
"I'm hungry, sir," said Jorgis.
"Hungry? Why don't you have some supper?"
"I've got no money, sir."
"No money?" "Well, let's be chums, old boy. Just like me. No money either. Almost busted. Well, why don't you go home, then? Same as me."
"I haven't any home," said Jorgis.
"No home? Stranger in the city, eh? Good God, that's bad. Better come home with me. Yep, by Harry, that's the trick. You'll come home and have some supper. with me. Yeah, awful lonesome, nobody home. Governor gone abroad, Bubby's on honeymoon, Polly's having twins, every damn soul gone away. Enough to drive a fellow to drink, I say. Only old Ham standing by passing plates. Damn, fuck, can eat that like that. No, sir. The club for me every time, my boy, I say. But then they won't let me sleep there. Governor's orders. By Harry, home every night, sir. ever hear anything like that? Every morning, do I ask him? No, sir, every night. No allowance at all, sir. That's my governor. Nice as nails. By Harry. Told old Ham to watch me, too. Servants spying on me. What did you think of that, my friend? A nice, quiet, good-hearted young fella like me and his daddy can't go to Europe and leave him in peace. Ain't that a shame, sir? And I gotta go home every evening and miss all the fun. By Harry, that's what's matter now. That's why I'm here. Had to come away and leave Kitty. Left her crying, too. What'd you think of that, old sport? Let me go, kittens, says I. Come early and often. I go where duty calls me. Farewell. Farewell, my own true love. Farewell, farewell, my own true love.
This last was a song, and the young gentleman's voice rose mournful and wailing while he swung upon Jorgis's neck. The latter was glancing about nervously, lest someone should approach. They were still alone, however.
"But I came all right,"
continued the youngster aggressively. "I can
have my own way when I want it, by Harry. Freddy Jones is a hard man to handle when he gets going. No, sir," says I, by thunder, "and I don't need anybody going home with me either. Who'd you take me for, eh? You think I'm drunk, don't you, huh? I know you, but I'm no more drunk than you are, kittens," says I to her. And then says she, "That's true, Freddy dear. She's a smart one, Kitty. But I'm staying in the flat, and you're going out into the cold, cold night. Put it in a poem, lovely Kitty," says I. "No joking, Freddy, my boy," says she. "Let me call a cab now, like good dear. Well, I can call my own cabs, don't you fool yourself. And I know what I'm doing, you bet. Say, my friend, what'd you say? Will you come home and see me and have some supper? Come along like a good fella. Don't be hardy. You're up against it same as me, and you can understand a fella. Your heart's in the right place, by hey. Come along, old chappie. We'll light up the house. We'll have some fizz. And we'll raise hell, we will. So long. I'm inside the house. I can do as I please. Governor's own very orders, begod. Hip, hip."
They had started down the street, arm in arm, the young man pushing Jorgis along, half-dazed. Jorgis was trying to think what to do. He knew he could not pass any crowded place with his new acquaintance without attracting attention and being stopped. It was only because of the falling snow that people who passed here did not notice anything wrong. Suddenly, therefore, Jorgis stopped.
"Is it very far?" he inquired. "Not very," said the other. "Tired, are you? Well, we'll ride. What you say? Good. Call a cab."
And then, gripping Jorgis tight with one hand, the young fellow began searching his pockets with the other.
"You call, old sport, and I'll pay," he suggested. "How's that, eh?"
And he pulled out from somewhere a big roll of bills. It was more money than Jorgis had ever seen in his life before, and he stared at it with startled eyes.
"Looks like a lot, eh?" said Master Freddy, fumbling with it. "Fool you, though, old chappie. They're all little ones. I'll be busted in 1 week more. Sure thing. Word of honor, and not a cent more till the first governor's orders, eh? Not a cent, by Harry. Enough to set a fella crazy, it is. I sent him a cable this afternoon. That's one reason more why I'm going home. Hanging on the verge of starvation, I says, for the honor of the family. Send me some bread. Hunger will compel me to join you, Freddy. That's what I wired him, by Harry, and I mean it. I'll run away from school, begod, if you don't send me some."
After this fashion, the young gentleman continued to prattle on. And meantime, Jorgis was trembling with excitement. He might grab that wad of bills and be out of sight in the darkness before the other could collect his wits. Should he do it? What better had he to hope for if he waited longer? But Jorgis had never committed a crime in his life, and now he hesitated half a second too long. Freddy got one bill loose and then stuffed the rest back into his trousers pocket.
"Here, old man," he said. "You take it."
He held it out fluttering. They were in front of a saloon, and by the light of the window, Jorgis saw that it was a $100 bill.
"You take it," the other repeated. "Pay the cabby and keep the change. I've got no head for business. The governor says so himself, and the governor knows. The governor's got a head for business, you bet." "All right, governor," I told him, "you run the show and I'll take the tickets." And so he set Aunt Polly to watch me. And now Polly's off of the hospital having twins and me out raising Cain. "Hello there." "Call him."
A cab was driving by, and Jorgis sprang and called, and it swung round to the curb. Master Freddy clambered in with some difficulty, and Jorgis had started to follow when the driver shouted,
"Hi there! Get out, you!"
Jorgis hesitated and was half obeying, but his companion broke out,
What's the matter with you, eh?"
And the cabby subsided, and Jorgis climbed in. Then Freddy gave a number on the Lakeshore Drive, and the carriage started away. The youngster leaned back and snuggled up to Jorgis, murmuring contentedly. In half a minute he was sound asleep. Jorgis sat shivering, speculating as to whether he might not still be able to get hold of the roll of bills. He was afraid to try to go through his companion's pockets, however, and besides, the cabby might be on the watch. He had the 100 safe, and he would have to be content with that. At the end of half an hour or so, the cab stopped. They were out on the waterfront, and from the east, a freezing gale was blowing off the ice-bound lake.
"Here we are," called the cabby, and Jorgis awakened his companion.
Master Freddy sat up with a start.
"Hello?" he said. "Where are we? What's this? Who are you, eh? Oh, sure enough, most forgot you. Old chappy, home, are we? Let's see. Oh, it's cold, yeah. Come along. We're home, being ever so humble."
Before them, there loomed an enormous granite pile set far back from the street and occupying a whole block. By the light of the driveway lamps, Jorgis could see that it had towers and huge gables like a medieval castle. He thought that the young fellow must have made a mistake. It was inconceivable to him that any person could have a home like a hotel or the city hall. But he followed in silence, and they went up the long flight of steps, arm in arm.
"There's a button here, old sport," said Master Freddy. "Hold my arm while I find her. Steady. Now. Oh, yeah. Here she is. Saved."
A bell rang, and in a few seconds the door was opened. A man in blue livery stood holding it, and gazing before him, silent as a statue. They stood for a moment, blinking in the light. Then Jorgis felt his companion pulling, and he stepped in, and the blue automaton closed the door. Jorgis's heart was beating wildly. It was a bold thing for him to do. Into what strange, unearthly place he was venturing, he had no idea. Aladdin entering his cave could not have been more excited. The place where he stood was dimly lighted, but he could see a vast hall with pillars fading into the darkness above, and a great staircase opening at the far end of it. The floor was of tessellated marble, smooth as glass, and from the walls strange shapes loomed out, woven into huge portières in rich, harmonious colours, or gleaming from paintings, wonderful and mysterious-looking in the half-light purple and red and golden, like sunset glimmers in a shadowy forest. The man in livery had moved silently toward them. Master Freddy took off his hat and handed it to him, and then, letting go of Jorgis's arm, tried to get out of his overcoat. After two or three attempts, he accomplished this with the lackey's help, and meantime a second man had approached, a tall and portly personage, solemn as an executioner. He bore straight down upon Jorgis, who shrank away nervously. He seized him by the arm, without a word, and started toward the door with him. Then suddenly came Master Freddy's voice.
"Hamilton, my friend will remain with me."
The man paused and half released Jorgis.
"Come along, old chappy,"
said the other, and Jorgis started toward him.
"Master Frederick,"
exclaimed the man.
"See that the cabby is paid,"
was the other's response, and he linked his arm in Jorgis's. Jorgis was about to say, "I have the money for him," but he restrained himself. The stout man in uniform signaled to the other, who went out to the cab, while he followed Jorgis and his young master. They went down the great hall and then turned. Before them were two huge doors.
"Hamilton," said Master Freddy.
"Well, sir," said the other.
"What's the matter? Was the dining room doors?"
"Nothing is the matter, sir."
"Why don't you open them?"
The man rolled them back. Another vista lost itself in the darkness.
"Lights,"
commanded Master Freddy, and the butler pressed a button, and a flood of brilliant incandescence streamed from above, half blinding Jorgis. He stared, and little by little he made out the great apartment, with a domed ceiling from which the light poured, and walls that were one enormous painting, nymphs and dryads dancing in a flower-strewn glade, Diana with her hounds and horses dashing headlong through a mountain streamlet, a group of maidens bathing in a forest pool, all life-size and so real that Jorgis thought that it was some work of enchantment, that he was in a dream palace. Then his eye passed to the long table in the center of the hall, a table black as ebony and gleaming with wrought silver and gold. In the center of it was a huge carven bowl with the glistening gleam of ferns and the red and purple of rare orchids glowing from a light hidden somewhere in their midst.
"This is the dining room," observed Master Freddy. "How you like it, hey, old sport?"
He always insisted on having an answer to his remarks, leaning over Jorgis and smiling into his face. Jorgis liked it.
"Rummy old place to feed in all alone, though," was Freddy's comment. "Rummy as hell. What did you think, eh?"
Then another idea occurred to him, and he went on without waiting.
"Maybe you never saw anything like this before, old chappie?"
"No," said Jorgis.
"Come from a country, maybe, huh?"
"Yes," said Jorgis.
"Ah, I thought so. Lots of folks from country never saw such place. Governor brings them free show, regular circus. Go home, tell folks about it. Old man's lonesome place. Loans the pack, a beef trust man. Made it all out of hogs, too. Damn old scoundrel. Now we see where our pennies go. Rebates and private car lines. By Harry. Bully place, though. Worth seeing. Ever hear of Jones the packer, hey, old chappie?"
Jorgis had started involuntarily. The other, whose sharp eyes missed nothing, demanded,
"What's the matter, eh? You heard of him?"
And Jorgis managed to stammer out,
"I have worked for him in the yards."
"What?"
cried Master Freddy with a yell.
"You? In the yards? I say, that's good. Shake hands on it, old man, by Harry. Governor ought to be here. Glad to see you. Great friends with the men, Governor. Labor and capital, community, interests, and all that. Funny things happen in this world, don't they, old man? Hamilton, let me introduce you to a friend of the family. Old friend, the governor's works in the yards. Come to spend the night with me, Hamilton. Have a hard time. Me friend, Mr. What's your name, old chappie? Tell us your name."
"Rutkis. Jorgis Rutkis.
My friend, Mr. Rednose, Hamilton. Shake hands."
The stately butler bowed his head, but made not a sound. And suddenly Master Freddy pointed an eager finger at him.
"I know what's the matter with you, Hamilton. Lay you a dollar, I know. You think... you think I'm drunk, eh, now?"
And the butler again bowed his head.
"Yes, sir,"
he said, at which Master Freddy hung tightly upon Jorgis's neck and went into a fit of laughter.
"Hamilton, you damn old scoundrel," he roared. "I'll charge you for impudence. You see if I don't. I'm drunk."
The two waited until his fit had spent itself to see what new whim would seize him.
"What you want to do?"
he queried suddenly.
"Want to see the place, old sappy? Want me to play the governor? Show you around? State parlors, Louis Cannes, Louis Say's chairs cost $3,000 apiece. tea room, Mary Antoinette, pictures of shepherds dancing rice deer, $23,000. Ballroom balcony pillars, imported. Special ship, $68,000. Ceiling painted in Rome.
What's that fella's name? Hamilton? Matt, Tony, Macaroni, then this place, Silver Bowl, Benvenuto Cellini, Remy Old Dago, and the organ. $37,000, sir. Start her up, Hamilton. Let Mr. Red Nose hear it. No, never mind. Clean forgot. Says he's hungry. Hamilton, let's have some supper. Only, don't let's have it here. Come up to my place, old sport, nice and cozy. This way. Steady now. Don't slip on the floor. Hamilton, we'll have a cold spread and some fizz. Don't leave out the fizz, by Harry. We'll have some of the 1830 Madeira. You hear me, sir?
Yes, sir, said the butler. But Master Frederick, your father left orders. And Master Frederick drew himself up to a stately height.
My father's orders were left to me, and not to you, he said.
Then clasping Jorgis tightly by the neck, he staggered out of the room. On the way, another idea occurred to him, and he asked,
Any cable message for me, Hamilton?
No, sir, said the butler.
Governor must be travelling. How's the twins, Hamilton?
They're doing well, sir.
Good, said Master Freddy, and added fervently, God bless them, the little lambs.
They went up the great staircase one step at a time. At the top of it, there gleamed at them out of the shadows the figure of a nymph crouching by a fountain, a figure ravishingly beautiful, the flesh warm and glowing with the hues of life. Above was a huge court with domed roof, the various apartments opening into it. The butler had paused below but a few minutes to give orders, and then followed them. Now he pressed a button, and the hall blazed with light. He opened a door before them, and then pressed another button as they staggered into the apartment. It was fitted up as a study. In the center was a mahogany table, covered with books and smokers' implements. The walls were decorated with college trophies and colors, flags, posters, photographs and knick-knacks, tennis rackets, canoe paddles, golf clubs and polo sticks. An enormous moose head with horns 6 feet across faced a buffalo head on the opposite wall, while bear and tiger skins covered the polished floor. There were lounging chairs and sofas, window seats covered with soft cushions of fantastic designs. There was one corner fitted in Persian fashion with a huge canopy and a jeweled lamp beneath. Beyond, a door opened upon a bedroom, and beyond that was a swimming pool of the purest marble that had cost about $40,000. Master Freddy stood for a moment or two, gazing about him. Then, out of the next room, a dog emerged, a monstrous bulldog, the most hideous object that Jorgis had ever laid eyes upon. He yawned, opening a mouth like a dragon's, and he came toward the young man, wagging his tail.
"Hello, Dewey," cried his master. "Been having a snooze, old boy? Well, well, hello there. What's the matter?"
The dog was snarling at Jorgis.
"Why, Dewey, this is my friend, Mr. Rednose, old friend the governor's. Mr. Rednose, Admiral Dewey. Shake hands. ain't he a daisy, though? Blue ribbon at the New York show, 8,500 at a clip. How's that, huh?"
The speaker sank into one of the big armchairs, and Admiral Dewey crouched beneath it. He did not snarl again, but he never took his eyes off Jorgis. He was perfectly sober, was the admiral. The butler had closed the door, and he stood by it, watching Jorgis every second. Now, there came footsteps outside, and as he opened the door, a man in livery entered, carrying a folding table, and behind him two men with covered trays. They stood like statues while the first spread the table and set out the contents of the trays upon it. There were cold pâtés, and thin slices of meat, tiny bread and butter sandwiches with the crust cut off, a bowl of sliced peaches and cream, in January, little fancy cakes, pink and green and yellow and white, and half a dozen ice-cold bottles of wine.
"That's the stuff for you," cried Master Freddy,
exultantly, as he spied them.
"Come along, old chappie, move up."
And he seated himself at the table. The waiter pulled a cork, and he took the bottle and poured three glasses of its contents in succession down his throat. Then he gave a long-drawn sigh and cried again to Jorgis to seat himself. The butler held the chair at the opposite side of the table, and Jorgis thought it was to keep him out of it, but finally he understood that it was the other's intention to put it under him, and so he sat down, cautiously and mistrustingly. Master Freddy perceived that the attendants embarrassed him, and he remarked with a nod to them,
"You may go."
They all went, all save the butler.
"You may go too, Hamilton,"
he said.
"Master Frederick," the man began.
"Go!"
cried the youngster angrily.
"Damn you, don't you hear me?"
The man went out and closed the door. Jorgis, who was as sharp as he, observed that he took the key out of the lock in order that he might peer through the keyhole. Master Frederick turned to the table again.
"Now,"
he said,
"go for it."
Jorgis gazed at him doubtingly.
"Eighth," cried the other. "Pile in, old chappy."
"Don't you want anything?"
Jorgis asked.
"Ain't hungry,"
was the reply.
"Only thirsty. Kitty and me had some candy." "You go on."
So, Jorgis began without further parley. He ate as with two shovels, his fork in one hand and his knife in the other. When he got once started, his wolf hunger got the better of him, and he did not stop for breath until he had cleared every plate.
"Gee whiz,"
said the other, who had been watching him in wonder. Then he held Jorgis the bottle.
"Let's see you drink now,"
he said. And Jorgis took the bottle and turned it up to his mouth, and a wonderfully unearthly liquid ecstasy poured down his throat, tickling every nerve of him, thrilling him with joy. He drank the very last drop of it, and then he gave vent to a long-drawn, "Ah!"
"Good stuff, eh?"
said Freddy, sympathetically. He had leaned back in the big chair, putting his arm behind his head and gazing at Jorgis. And Jorgis gazed back at him. He was clad in spotless evening dress, was Freddy, and looked very handsome. He was a beautiful boy, with light golden hair and the head of an Antinous. He smiled at Jorgis confidingly, and then started talking again with his blissful insouciance. This time he talked for 10 minutes at a stretch, and in the course of the speech he told Jorgis all of his family history. His big brother Charlie was in love with the guileless maiden who played the part of Little Bright Eyes in The Caliph of Kamskatka. He had been on the verge of marrying her once, only the governor had sworn to disinherit him and had presented him with a sum that would stagger the imagination, and that had staggered the virtue of Little Bright Eyes. Now Charlie had got leave from college and had gone away in his automobile on the next best thing to a honeymoon. The governor had made threats to disinherit another of his children also, Sister Gwendolyn, who had married an Italian marquis with a string of titles and a dueling record. They lived in his chateau, or rather had, until he had taken to firing the breakfast dishes at her. Then she had cabled for help, and the old gentleman had gone over to find out what were his grace's terms. So they had left Freddy all alone, and he with less than $2,000 in his pocket. Freddy was up in arms and meant serious business, as they would find in the end. If there was no other way of bringing them to terms, he would have his kittens wire that she was about to marry him, and see what happened then. So the cheerful youngster rattled on until he was tired out. He smiled his sweetest smile at Jorgis, and then he closed his eyes sleepily. Then he opened them again, and smiled once more, and finally closed them and forgot to open them. For several minutes Jorgis sat perfectly motionless, watching him, and reveling in the strange sensation of the champagne. Once he stirred, and the dog growled. After that he sat almost holding his breath, until after a while the door of the room opened softly, and the butler came in. He walked toward Jorgis upon tiptoe, scowling at him, and Jorgis rose up and retreated, scowling back. So, until he was against the wall, and then the butler came close and pointed toward the door,
"Get out of here," he whispered.
Jorgis hesitated, giving a glance at Freddy, who was snoring softly.
"If you do, you son of a—" hissed the butler. "I'll mash in your face for you before you get out of here."
And Jorgis wavered but an instant more. He saw Admiral Dewey coming up behind the man and growling softly to back up his threats. Then he surrendered and started toward the door. They went out without a sound and down the great echoing staircase and through the dark hall. At the front door he paused, and the butler strode close to him. "Hold up your hands," he snarled. Jorgis took a step back, clenching his one well fist.
"What for?"
he cried, and then, understanding that the fellow proposed to search him, he answered,
"I'll see you in hell first."
"Do you want to go to jail?"
demanded the butler menacingly. "I'll have the police."
"Have 'em,"
roared Jorgis, with fierce passion.
"But you won't put your hands on me till you do. I haven't touched anything in your damned house, and I'll not have you touch me."
So the butler, who was terrified lest his young master should waken, stepped suddenly to the door and opened it.
"Get out of here,"
he
he said, and then, as Jorgis passed through the opening, he gave him a ferocious kick that sent him down the great stone steps at a run and landed him sprawling in the snow at the bottom. The end of chapter 24. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.